This is 16.9 The Podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. We're all about digital signage and have been since 2006. We cover what's interesting now and what will be interesting and important one day soon. And we filter out all the BS. This podcast is a chance to add depth and color to what we do online, and it gives smart people a chance to really talk about their companies and their ideas. You can hear new episodes weekly on your smartphone, tablet, or desktop, free of charge. 16.9 is sponsored and supported by ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. ScreenFeed makes beautiful, ready-made, auto-delivered, and auto-updated content for screens. This week we're doing a little way-back thing, talking to someone who's been working specifically at digital signage for almost 25 years, for a company that's been at it for 30 years. One of the events that's part of all the Digital Signage Week stuff in New York next week is one that's marking three decades in business for Scala, one of the best-known brands in this industry. Peter Cherna joined the company as a software developer in 1993, and he's now Scala's Chief Product Officer. He's basically the guy making all the decisions around what the content management system does and delivers. We chatted about the really early days of Scala, which was started in Norway and built at the time off the old Commodore Amiga computer and software platform. He was at Commodore, and like several other developers there, got off what was a sinking ship and joined Scala. We get into a little bit of the history of the company and this industry, but we also look at what's going on with technology these days and how things are evolving. Peter, thanks for joining me. I really wanted to talk to you because I got an invitation from Scala, and I guess by extension Stratacache, saying that there was a 30th anniversary party coming up in New York for the company. And I thought, wow, 30 years. And I asked your boss, Chris Regal, who actually has been around that long. And he said, well, nobody, but Peter Cherna has been there since 93. So he'd be a great person to talk to. So here we are. You joined Scala in 93. At that point, what was your role?
Hi, glad to be here. So it's actually the origin story of how we got to be in the U.S. with R&D is kind of interesting. So the company was founded in October 87 in Norway by a gentleman by the name of Jon Bøhmer, or John, as he's usually called. Mm-hmm. And we were incorporated in the U.S., I think, in 92, and there was a sales and marketing office down in Washington, D.C., and the board of directors decided that what they really wanted is they wanted to have R&D in the U.S. as well as in Norway. And so at the time, Scala ran on the Amiga platform and Commodore was struggling. And so Scala understood that if their business was to continue, they also had to move onto a more mainstream platform. Mm-hmm. And so they were working with Jeff Porter, and Jeff was VP of engineering at Commodore. And sort of through that connection, a bunch of us met with the Scala people, and they started hiring people as they were leaving Commodore in kind of the dying days. And so a gentleman by the name of Mike Sins left in, I guess, June of 93 and became the first Scala R&D employee in the U.S. And then 3 months later, he kind of reeled me over, and then we started hiring people from the area, but also quite a few people that were connected to the Commodore Amiga in some fashion. And so I came over to Scala to work on mostly the user interface of the designer application, which at that time was just called Scala MM. And so I did a lot of the underpinnings and a little bit of the design for that. Mm-hmm. And that's where I began.
So you were a software developer.
I was a software developer. I was working at Commodore for 4 or 5 years before I came over here, yeah.
And for the young folks out there who don't really know what Commodore really is, could you describe the company and why was Commodore going down?
So Commodore had made a great commercial success with some early microcomputers, VIC-20 and Commodore 64, and I knew about those. I never had one, never really played much with them. But then a company in California called Amiga had come up with a design for a pretty revolutionary machine. It was so far ahead of its time, and Commodore ultimately bought it when Amiga was in financial difficulty, and they launched the Amiga 1000 in 85, and it was really the only way to do high-quality video affordably on microcomputer in those days was on the Amiga, because PCs were typically monochrome, Macs were black and white, PCs with, I guess, color cards had limited colors, Apple IIs existed, had limited colors. So people that were doing video were mostly doing it on Commodore 64s and on Amigas, and you know, some of the very famous products were the Video Toaster, which was used in a lot of live broadcast titling and several key television shows. Like there was a Roy Scheider show called I forget what, but it was he was a submarine commander, and a lot of the graphics were done on the Amiga. Babylon 5, the graphics were done on the Amiga. So there was a really large and vibrant community of video developers, video designers that were doing things on the Amiga that could be done for a couple thousand dollars of hardware that would have taken $50,000 or $100,000 to do any other way. And unfortunately, the management of Commodore really didn't understand what they had. They didn't know how to sell it, and they drove it into the ground. And, you know, but the engineering team was really full of gifted people. And those people, a lot of them came to Scala. A number of them went on to work on other systems like 3DO. There's key people now from the Amiga days that are at Google, that are at Microsoft, that are at Roku, and all kinds of places that really, where video and technology intersect, you'll always find people that cut their teeth on the Amiga.
Mm-hmm. And Scala, when it started out, that was a broadcast piece of software, right?
So the guy that invented it, he had the idea that one could somehow or other marry computers and television. And so he came up with the idea of a tool to make content and put it up on a screen. And most of his early customers were in Scandinavia, and they were either hotels that wanted hotel TV, whether it was in the lobby or in the room, but also a lot of cable companies and broadcast TV companies that had no nighttime programming. And so they would run an info channel station computer to create or playback content, whether it was weather or news or, you know, a local lottery numbers or things like that, running on all these channels, TV channels, in the dead of night. And I remember visiting Oslo in 93 and 94, and with the jet lag, sometimes I'd be up in the middle of the night and channel flipping on TV, and there's probably 14 channels between the hotel system and the local cable company. And I remember like 9 of the 14 channels had Scala running at 3 in the morning. So, like, this feels like a reasonable company to work for.
Huh. And at what point did digital signage, the idea of putting this kind of content on screens other than TV, start to kind of bubble up?
So, I mean, in the early days, there really weren't flat screen LCDs and plasma. So they were, you know, CRT or TV style monitors that were used in what everyone today would recognize as digital signage. So there was a shopping center in Stockholm called Adam and Eva, and I think all the tenants in the shopping center were fashion related. And so we actually did a project there in the early days before my time.
Wow.
Where all this stuff was used. So they were putting up, you know, some ads, some environmental, they were like showcasing product and fashion stuff. It wasn't, you know, prices and products as much in those days. People were still in the early days of exploring, you know, what made sense on the screen, what looked good on a screen, what was effective on a screen. And obviously, you know, now we have much larger canvases to work with, much greater graphic ability. You can do approach the problem quite differently. But when you had, I don't know, what would probably be the equivalent to a 15 or 16 inch CRT tube, yeah, it was more limited, and these screens had to be closer to the customer. But we had early projects in convenience stores, and those were really, you know, retail digital signage focused with, you know, soda offers and snack food offers right on them.
Huh. And did any of those persist?
So a lot of that stuff came and went. We've certainly, you know, had customers that were ours in the early days, and we've gone back to them in some cases since. You know, a lot of the knowledge of the specific early customers ultimately got lost. I did a bunch of historical research when we moved in terms of sorting through the old magazines and news clippings and files and keeping, you know, one of everything and getting rid of a lot of redundant stuff. So, you know, we rediscovered a bit of our history that in that project. But yeah, I mean, a lot of that information is lost to the mists of time now.
So when you came over and Commodore Amiga was dying, you had to, was there much of the source code that could be repurposed for PC, or did you pretty much have to start over?
So we both, it was both. I mean, we decided we had to start over. There was no, it was a good time to refresh the code. There wasn't a lot of commonality in the architecture. We ended up with a pretty large team, so we were able to move pretty fast in creating that. We had, at the time, about a dozen people each in Oslo and in Pennsylvania. And then we had like three or four people scattered around the globe where we had, you know, found highly talented people where they were. So we actually have been doing, you know, distributed development since pretty much the beginning when I started. So 1993, by then we already had, you know, multiple R&D teams on different continents with people everywhere. And yeah, all of that went with that. So.
And what could you do then versus what you obviously do at one hell of a lot more now? What were the limitations back in 93, 94?
Well, I'm hoping that we'll show some old video. So the final Amiga version was pretty capable. I mean, you could do, I mean, this was before video, so you could do kind of, they were other file formats than AnimGIF, but think of them as a glorified AnimGIF. So you could do pretty much full screen AnimGIF class animation. So they were, you know, hard to produce because there weren't a lot of tools for them. And they didn't have a lot of colors on the Amiga. You were limited to 16 or 32 colors. You had a large palette you could work with, and we had some really intelligent color processing software to automate all that. So it looked really good. But you could do pictures, you could do text. We had, you know, variables, we had scripting, you could do interfacing to serial ports, parallel ports, files, stuff like that. So a lot of the, you know, early applications, we were able to do some pretty advanced stuff, like integrate with flight information systems, and we did some casino integration, and we had Keno games that where the number sequences were displayed on a channel in the room, and there might even have been some like touch tone integration, so you could actually, you know, control what was going on a little better. But primarily it was pictures and text, but there weren't, you know, scalable typefaces, and there wasn't anything that would pass for video. There was motion, but no video. And we had lots of motion effects to make up for that. So
you're describing all this, and I'm wondering, when you see announcements from other companies over the last 2-3 years about things like data integration, working with different platforms, using their APIs and all that, you're describing stuff that you were doing 25 years ago, that's kind of like that. Is it funny to sit there and see people jumping up and down all excited about doing something, and you're thinking to yourself, yeah, we did that in 95?
So part of it is everything old is new again. And I think, you know, that came up recently on your blog where you posted about that Coca-Cola sign in Times Square with the moving cubes, and you know, I had a flashback to Expo 67, which is 50 years ago, when, you know, I was 2, and yeah, digital signage didn't really exist even much in science fiction, probably. Obviously, the way you do data integration in 2017 is wholly different than the way we did it in 1995. But yeah, we really did tackle, you know, a lot of the same problems, and a lot of it was, you know, incredibly more primitive, since, you know, there weren't web standards, and, you know, connectivity itself was a miracle. And now, you know, so much of the world, you can just assume that the internet's there, and the data is well formed, and there are, you know, easy libraries to connect and talk to it using JavaScript or Python or other, you know, modern web technologies to just, you know, or sort of scripting technologies to get it. Or, and, you know, there's so much web technology for data connection through JSON and all this other stuff that just makes a lot of this problem quite easy if the connection's up.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so one of the interesting things I did recently was I was in London in May, and I gave a presentation on the history of digital signage. And you know, it wasn't a Scala presentation per se. Like, it wasn't our history as much as it was a walk through what was happening in technology and the industry. And obviously, you know, a lot of the examples were Scala, particularly the early ones, because it's really difficult to find other people's early history. A lot of the modern examples I had, you know, showed it plenty of examples, including like Apple stores and the Oculus in New York City, which, you know, are great projects that are not us. Mm-hmm. But in the early days, obviously the examples were all ours. But then I came across a person that had some information on the Philips Video Pack, which was a video game console from 1978, which actually sold in Europe as the Video Pack from Philips. And then Magnavox was the brand they used in the US. So the Magnavox Odyssey and Odyssey 2 had a cartridge that did essentially basic digital signage in 1978. And you could type in a, I don't know, 30 or 100 character message that would scroll across in a black bar. And it was smooth scrolling one character at a time, tack, 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 tack. But you could have like a message and time. It had a couple of other features, but you could have the current time and a message. And yeah, it actually works. And I set up an emulator. So I ran the emulator and made a little video clip that basically brought 1978 digital signage back to life for 2017. So when you say, you know, does Scala have all these flashback memories of, oh, you know, we were doing that when we were knee high to a grasshopper. The truth is, you know, some aspects of this are actually, you know, the same applies to us. And there were people that were thinking about this and having very early results, you know, well before we came into being. But, you know, that being said, we still were early in the professional digital signage and in terms of making things come together and work and figuring out, like, okay, how do we bring this project to life that seems impossible? And, you know, we were there when a lot of those early challenges were being faced. Mm-hmm.
It takes time and real money to make and host this podcast, so I'm grateful for the continuing support of ScreenFeed.
Hi, this is Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed. I hope you're enjoying the podcast as much as I am. I've loved Dave's blog since we started in the industry. It's now our 10th year at ScreenFeed, and we've grown to be a reliable partner for the industry, serving over 1,700 customers with over 100,000 screens globally, and we're currently getting 10 million content requests daily. But more important than that is that we make content beautiful, functional for the medium, and we help our customers meet their goals of increasing viewership and satisfying customers. If you don't know how ScreenFeed can help you, it's worth 5 minutes to browse our website or give us a call. If you're out walking your dog, driving home, or relaxing on your favorite chair, just make a mental note to check us out. Now back to the podcast.
I remember putting a blog post up a couple of years ago about Michael Lazaridis, one of the founders of BlackBerry, and how in 1984 he was marketing a digital signage product in shopping malls in Kitchener-Waterloo. So it just goes way back.
Yeah. And I mean, it was so different then because, I mean, first of all, the costs per location or per installation were that much higher. I mean, if you think about the first flat screens were probably in the 30-inch range, 32-inch, something like that. And they probably, I mean, the farther back you go, the more expensive they were. But I certainly remember plenty of screens that were $15,000 for the screen. And at that time, a media player would have been, you know, the PC itself would have been around $3,000, give or take, and the software probably another two. So you're looking at $20,000 just to do one. And you know, now you can, I mean, it depends on, like, the least expensive solutions that you could cobble together today would be to take a, you know, go to a Walmart, Target, Best Buy type store. And you know, I saw 4K 55-inch smart TV for, I don't even remember what, $650. So, you know, and if it doesn't have the media engine you need, you can slap a stick in open source software. And so, yeah, a lot of it's left as an exercise to the reader. But you think $15,000 and now you have a screen with four times the surface area and probably 20 times the pixel count.
Yeah.
And instead of it being $15,000, it's sub 1,000. So you step up to a, you know, professional 24/7 media player and, you know, software that has full management, and it's a little bit more, but it's still, you know, well more than order of magnitude cheaper. Mm-hmm. And you can't do a, you know, six screen menu board if it's $30,000 to $15,000 per screen. And, you know, if you go back to before there were flat screens, then you had the thickness of the CRT meant that it was really difficult to adapt to an environment. So, you know, if you had a convenience store with a high ceiling, you could hang kind of steel pipes down and suspend a CRT from that. And airports usually were tall, and the, you know, governments could fund and information displays were possible. And in those environments, it could happen. But to walk into like a clothing retailer and expect to be able to find space for this, let alone the budget, let alone, okay, now we need to get connectivity so we can remote update these things. And yeah, the world has completely changed since then.
Slightly weird question. Is there anything back then that was actually easier to do than it is now as a developer?
Is there anything that was easier to do? I think, I mean, we were, I would say, I feel like almost everything has gotten easier, except, you know, obviously we run at a much bigger scale now, and the kind of engineering work you need to do to handle multiple thousand locations, you know, which is would be a premier network in most parts of the world, or multiple hundred locations, which is a big network in a lot of parts of the world too, that's quite a bit more difficult than, you know, what it would take to run our largest networks from those days when we had, you know, 5, 10, 20 media players connected. And even though they were connected by modem, the logistics of making sure that it worked robustly at scale, that so then the scalability complexity has gotten harder. And I think the other thing is that as the systems have gotten more complex, making sure that they're 24/7 stable, which has been a long engineering investment at Scala to get that right from the early days and keep it that way, I think that's gotten harder. That was easier in the old days. We had a, you know, there were people that understood the platform top to bottom, and every in and out of the Amiga was known to the Scala software team, and they could master that. And I think no one can say they can completely master an Android platform or Linux platform or a Windows platform and know all of the details. So these systems always have dark corners with some surprises. And so, you know, as much as you lock them down and as much as people have learned about embedded design, when the systems were simpler, you know, embedded design where you could completely control and predict the behavior was easier when things were three orders of magnitude less complicated from a, you know, transistor count point of view or system complexity point of view.
Are there any aspects of what was written in 93, 94, 95 that still exists within the current Scala platform?
So the goal then was, you know, we love the spirit of the software. It has a very playful feel. It was approachable. You could get really, you know, impressive visual results quickly. And it was a big part of the DNA of the company that a user could sit down on the software and the feedback cycle for, you know, creating and working with stuff was very short. It was easy to make stuff. It was easy to see what happened. And when we rebuilt it, we said, you know, that's the spirit we want to preserve. And, you know, the code we threw out. So a lot of the design decisions that we made from a architectural point of view were all different, but a lot of the philosophical decisions were cut from the same cloth. And, you know, some of the UI, at least initially, was styled alongside. So if you looked at the first PC products, you definitely recognize those as sibling products to what was done on the Amiga. And there are traces of that today. But I would say, you know, it's really about preserving the spirit and then doing that as the software grows more and more functionality and complexity, which I think is where, you know, teams that have built software and had that software in the market for a long time have to put more and more effort into keeping the complexity tamed. I think of the Joshua tree cactus, which is a cactus that grows in sort of southeastern California and I guess Arizona, parts like that, which, you know, as it grows, if it leans too much to one way, it'll actually grow a pod on the opposite side in order to balance itself out, or so I've been told. And, you know, software that's matured has all these advantages because it's, you know, it's been through so many different scenarios and all that, but it does tend to grow accommodations for customers and for situations, especially where there are, you know, there are unique needs. Someone needs something and then we'll add something. And, you know, that in the short term builds in a lot of complexity, and we have to take time from time to time to kind of, you know, reimagine what we've done and kind of boil out some of that complexity and keep the capability. So for example, we have a big user experience project underway for our content manager that basically take our current user interface, which is probably 6 or 8 years old now, and, you know, really kind of rationalize it, clean it up, fix a lot of the things where we know we could streamline it. And it's really, you know, it was powerful for its day, and the toolkits that are available to build user interfaces have improved, but also, you know, we have that much more experience and we have that many features that arrived after the design was fleshed out, and that makes us look at the problem differently, and the way people use the software is different, and the prevalence of mobile among people that want to use the software is, you know, didn't exist really at the time that we started. So yeah, definitely, you know, sort of returning to the well and getting back to that original spirit that it's easy breezy and a little playful. You have to keep investing in that.
Scala was known for a lot of years as a company that would give you the software, give you the content creation tools within the software suite. Has the marketplace requirement, the need for that evolved because there are, you know, a lot of content creation tools out there in the cloud, and, well, I guess everything's pretty much in the cloud now.
Yeah, so that's Absolutely true. And in the early days when people didn't have a choice, it was a very accessible feature to say, hey, you can sit down and look how easy it is to make stuff in Scala versus you don't even know what to do elsewhere other than maybe, you know, make stills in Microsoft Paint or back in those days. And, you know, the world has changed a lot, as you said. And if you are a customer that has production teams either in or that you're, you know, working with as a through an agency, they are going to be using existing and best of breed tools. And, you know, no one wants us to compete with a best of breed animation tool that requires, you know, professional training to use. At the same time, you know, there's still things about how stuff lays out on a screen where, you know, unlike the web, you can't just scroll if there's too much text and things like that. There are aspects to screen design where we still can bring value, and there are aspects to production velocity where we can bring value. And you know, our designer tools still, we have customers telling us, you know, that their velocity, their ability to bang stuff out that looks good, is so much better than in the best tools that they can find that use HTML and other standards. So even though more and more people are using best of breed third-party tools and HTML for content, you know, there is still room for something that has that efficiency. Because, I mean, don't forget, if you're a person in charge of, let's say, a corporate communications network, you don't want to spend your whole day worrying about the stuff on this, making stuff for screen. You probably have 10 other jobs, and this is part of it. And if we can't support some ways for you to make content that looks good really fast, then the network becomes stale because you don't have time to keep it up because, you know, you're busy with your HR memos and your, you know, other important parts of your job. And then that network is at a higher risk of failure. Mm-hmm. So we're continuing to invest in ways to make the whole design experience, you know, easier, faster, and more streamlined. Because that's where I think the value is, rather than, you know, do we have our own tool? It's like, why do we have our own tool? And the reason why ultimately is because people have a job to do, which is to, you know, make the message that they have and do that efficiently and have it be a work of quality.
Mm-hmm. Has the volume and complexity of customer requests kind of calmed down as the industry has matured? I remember in my days when I was doing biz dev for a couple of software companies, damn near every customer had some customization that they required. They wanted new features and so on. But I wonder now if that's changed, as you've got so much under the hood already and data connectors are easier and so on, that maybe it's not as hard.
So that's a really interesting question. Early on, you know, the market really didn't organize itself into verticals. And so it was difficult as a company to focus because, you know, when we were young, we had this opera house and that sports stadium and that airport and that corporation and that, you know, nightclub launch one of project and that corporate spectacular presentation and that museum. And so, you know, there was a lot of running around trying to figure out how to support these diverse needs. And what that did is it led us really early into the idea that underneath this all, things need to be scriptable. There needs to be ways to interface so that you can have kind of a services team that takes care of the last mile, not just from a content creation or network deployment point of view, but actually, you know, creating the functionality that you need to complete the project to make it work. And we did a lot of that work internally. We did a lot of that work through our network of partners, and we trained up customers to do it where they needed. And that philosophy has been with us since the early days. I mean, even on the Amiga, we had a lot of that stuff. And now, you know, there's REST interfaces for talking to our content management system and lots of ways to interface to the media player, lots of ways to do it on the platform or through HTML or otherwise. So we kind of tried to democratize that so that we can have multiple ways to solve that. So in some cases, it's best that it goes into the core product. In some cases, it can be done as a services project by our teams or our partners or our customers. And yeah, as we see patterns emerge over time, we can nativize those functions and it becomes less and less of a big deal. So, you know, as you said, connectors become a product feature instead of a services job. And then if someone has something novel in data connection, it's pretty easy to just create the little piece. So yeah, that's gotten easier. At the same time, you know, we still see people trying to do more ambitious things, and whether that's, you know, real-time decision making based on audience and store analytics, whether that's, you know, trying to drive movement and mechanics and sensors and lighting. Although we did a lot of that stuff a long time ago, like the Miele Experience Center in the Netherlands was doing lighting and scent and all that powered through Scala. So we were tracking people's location in the store. And when you walked into the kitchen area, you'd smell fresh cherry pies, and there were scent emitters and stuff that did that. And so, but back then it was hard, but we see more people, you know, striving to do that and integrate with more systems and have a more holistic experience. So, you know, we're still seeing those requests. The you know, platform is really good at letting you integrate. And so, again, we can oftentimes we can prototype something without it having to be considered as a product feature. And then, you know, we'll build it a couple times. And then after services has seen it a few times, they'd be like, you know what, this would be really valuable if we could give this to everybody and let's talk about putting it into the core product. Mm-hmm.
As somebody who's been doing this for almost 25 years, how do you react when you see more and more companies coming into the space? They're all cloud hosted. They're young. They're nimble. They're using nothing but web services. And they're saying, we make this easy. We make it simple. You don't need legacy software. You don't need all that. You work with us instead.
So, you know, it's very interesting. It's an open question. You know, how many of them have a business plan that will deliver revenue to them, so that whether they'll still be around. You know, we've got obviously a track record. We have a lot of advantages of incumbency, but yeah, in the technology field, young upstarts always have a story they can tell that more seasoned veterans have difficulty with saying, you know, describing themselves that way. But at the same time, you know, we're working with major, major customers that are powering digital menu boards in thousands or tens of thousands of locations around the U.S. And it's like, you know, their entire business goes down if the menu boards go down. And I don't think that somebody who's got a, you know, bright looking product that's probably got, you know, decent fundamentals underneath it would at all be the right choice for a customer like that. So, you know, and we have the scale to produce hardware to our specifications. We're, you know, able to manufacture outdoor glass, touch screens, all these things are things that we can do in an integrated way. So we can become kind of a one-stop shop no matter what your needs are. So there's a place for them, just like there's a place for multiple car vendors. And yeah, and we're comfortable with our place. We have the ability to, I mean, comfortable but not complacent, I think, is the way we are. We're pretty well defined in terms of our marketplace. I mean, the StrataCash offerings really are focused on customers who want a full managed service at enterprise scale. And the Scala customers are often ones that are working with a partner or doing a part of it themselves. But we're still talking about, you know, medium and larger customers all in all. So, you know, the market will always shift. There are clearly far too many competitors. You know, they can't all succeed. StrataCash has been a powerful voice in sort of defining the future of the market with the acquisitions that Chris Riegel has made, including Scala. So, you know, he's really building a powerhouse that's in a different league than a lot of these other companies. And I wish them luck, but not too much luck.
All right. Good way to end it. Thank you very much, Peter.
My pleasure.
That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening and learned something. If you want to stay on top of what's happening and actually matters in digital signage, join thousands of readers who visit 16.9, that's 16-9.net, every day. If you like this podcast, please also check out the companion 16.9 podcast called Projects. That's done by Michael Tutton, and there's a new episode every second Friday. 16.9 the blog and now the podcasts are properties of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare bedroom in my house near Toronto. Thanks to our podcast sponsor, ScreenFeed, and thank you for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.